we're so used to seeing things that, in my opinion, aren't quite right in our treatment of animals.
Yeah, the less we eat, the less violence is being done, and the less destruction to the environment.
Everyone eats, and everyone has to make a moral decision every time that we sit down to the table.
Welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show, Western Canada's only radio program on animal advocacy and compassionate living. This is 100.5 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO, in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Today is Friday, June the 17th, 2016. I am your host, Allison Cole, and I'm joined here today by our guest host, Beck Wonders.
Hi there.
And Denise Swanson.
Hey.
Welcome, everyone. This week has been declared Animal Rights Appreciation Week, and for our first interview, we'll have Michael Weberman, Executive Director of the Farm Animal Rights Movement, on the show to speak about the Animal Rights 2016 National Conference, which is coming up in Los Angeles from July the 7th to 10th. This is the world's largest and longest-running AR conference, and I'm excited to be able to attend it again along with Denise here. Michael will be on the show soon to tell us all about it. And tomorrow, June the 18th, is Save a Fish Day. We all here know that fish are misunderstood and misrepresented in our society above the ocean. Ethologist Dr. Jonathan Balcombe knows this too, which is why he decided to write a book that brings the latest research on fishes to the forefront so that we can all learn about these amazing creatures and come to appreciate them and respect them. His new book is called What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. And we'll have a feature interview with Jonathan today on some of the discoveries and stories that he shares in his book. That interview is coming up in about 32 minutes, so please do stay tuned.
I can't wait for that interview, and yeah, please do stay tuned for that. As many of you probably know, Father's Day is coming up, June 19th on Sunday.
Sunday, yeah.
And I've just been really noticing this interesting rhetoric around Father's Day. It seems to be focused on certain attributes on what we think makes a father. For example, I've been noticing locally things like get your dad a meat subscription from Carnivore Club.
As a Father's Day gift?
As a Father's Day gift. So you would get monthly deliveries to your door of different meats. And,
that's terrible.
And then I've also been noticing things like specials for Father's Day, food specials like steak, duck legs, pork belly, things like that. And always with the slogan made with dad in mind, or treat your dad to a to the right steak, things like that. I don't know if anyone else has been noticing these things around Father's Day.
I think I stay away from that media advertising, but men eating meat it's always been a masculinized
right.
thing, hasn't it? So I think the media marketers are really taking that to the top for Father's Day, as you've been noticing yourself.
Yeah, the whole barbecue thing is very much
one.
A macho role.
Yeah.
And you know, another sort of part of our culture that really gets advertised for Father's Day is fishing,
mm-hmm.
right? I noticed like in the stores, there's a lot of cards with fishing motifs on them for Father's Day.
I've also been noticing cards like real men grill meat and bacon is a vegetable and meat is murder, tasty, tasty murder all around Father's Day. It's so weird.
That's like, not a card I would get for my dad, I can say that.
Neither. I'm trying to think of a father who I know who's actually like that, and I'm having a hard time coming up with someone. But I guess like a lot of these things are, you know, because they are so traditional and ingrained, people just do them. People just think like that's the right thing to do. But, you know, I kind of, I like the idea of getting to know not just getting to know, but thinking about the individualisms of who your father is. For example, my father is a geologist, biologist, historian. So I would, you know, think if I thought about treating him to something, I would take him for a hike, maybe in an interesting geological place. But because I know my father, the best Father's Day gift I could give him is not to celebrate Father's Day because he's not a fan of the holidays.
He wouldn't even want a meat subscription. Who doesn't want a meat subscription delivered right to your door?
Right. Yeah. I don't know if you have other ideas or things that alternatives that you would treat your father to.
I can think of a nice idea that I saw as an example years ago when it happened to be Father's Day one year. There was a work party organized at a local sanctuary here, Hearts on Noses Sanctuary, which is a pig sanctuary, and it was on Father's Day, and there were a lot of animal advocates there who were there to help the pigs, myself included, and one person was a father who loves animals, and he said to me that his wish for Father's Day was to attend this work party to be with the pigs, and so his children granted him that wish, and they went there with him. So isn't that the most beautiful thing you can think of, to ask for a Father's Day gift?
Yeah, and especially now as, you know, sanctuaries are becoming more popular and more widespread, and there's a local one here in Vancouver called Happy Herd, and I would totally take my dad to that, or anyone's father. Yeah,
absolutely.
Great idea. Better than the zoo.
Yeah, I think those are all great ideas. Absolutely.
This is also Animal Rights Awareness Week, June 13th to 19th this year. This was originated by a group called In Defense of Animals, U.S.-based but now international as well, since 1999, although this is the first year that it's really come to my awareness for some reason.
The Awareness Week has come to your awareness.
The awareness has come to my awareness.
Very appropriate.
And we must remember that our views of animals are very much culturally driven. We are taught and habituated to thinking of animals as the other, closer to objects than subjects, whereas in reality, each is the subject of his or her own life. There's this entrenched tendency to think of them in terms of how we can use them, whether as a pet, companion animal, research rat, food on our plate. And we may forget, too, that these individuals had a mother and a father. Developing this awareness is an urgent need for billions of animals affected. Take dairy production as a good example. Cows, instead of living natural lives with their young, are repeatedly restrained and artificially inseminated, with rods and human arms forced up their orifices in order to impregnate them. And the bewildered mothers and newborns are traumatically separated and the milk taken for a whole nother species, humans. So there needs to be a conscious connection between this reality and the consumption of dairy products like milk and cheese and yogurt and ice cream, and there needs to be education that there are excellent alternatives to these foods that do not involve animal abuse.
And that's just one example, right? Like, you just chose from the whole vast variety of animal exploitations that exist out there. So do we need an Animal Rights Appreciation Week? Certainly. But I would call for, you know, we need animal rights appreciation all the time, right?
Yeah, and that was just a tiny example, even though very vast. Look at laying hens. They have families, and we have researched how their families operate, and yet they have no family whatsoever in the industry.
Animals certainly aren't personified, and we'll find out later on the show in the interview with Jonathan Balcombe it's all about the inner lives of fishes. And I learned so much from reading that book and just learning how their whole culture exists that we just don't know here because we live above the ocean, but because also we're not entrenched in their societies. And I guess what you're saying, Denise, is animals have their own societies and cultures and individual personalities and likes and dislikes. And
I'm so grateful for Jonathan's book, because we get to learn about all of that rich culture under the sea that we know virtually nothing about up to now.
Yeah, or we will know later on the show. Well, thank you so much for that, Denise. Sure.
Hey there, Co-op Radio listeners. Do you like food? Of course you do. Would you like to learn more about food? Why not? Well, then tune in every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio, where we talk all about food, sourcing food, buying food, the politics of food, hey, even cooking food. Food, glorious food. Listen every Monday at 8 p.m. for Food Line Radio on Vancouver's Co-op Radio 100.5 FM.
Hope you're ready for some local animal rights related events. The first one coming up Saturday, June 25th, next week. It's the monthly chicken vigil on Commercial and Hastings. And if you're a local Vancouverite, you might not know that there's actually one of the biggest slaughterhouses on that corner. It's very well hidden. And on that morning, from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., there will be a vigil hosted by Liberation BC to bear witness to the plight of thousands of these chickens who die in this facility every day, as well as to show solidarity to the workers.
And on Sunday, June 26th, from 1 p.m. to 3 p.m., a media training workshop. Although mainstream news media is often biased under corporate ownership and control, media of all forms can nonetheless be useful tools for activists to draw attention to an issue. In this workshop, Anna Pippas, animal rights lawyer and director of farmed animal advocacy at Animal Justice, will provide a basic training in writing press advisories and releases, as well as offer tips on ways to interact with the media. The workshop is by donation. All proceeds go to Spartacus Books, which is where the workshop will be happening, Sunday, June 26, 1 to 3. The address is 3378 Findlay Street, Vancouver, which is roughly 18th and Commercial.
And our last event happening next month, a little down south in L.A., from July 7th to July 10th, it's the Animal Rights 2016 National Conference, hosted by Farm Animal Rights Movement. It will be one of the largest and long-running animal rights gatherings, and the conference will take place at the Sheraton Gateway Hotel in Los Angeles, California. So stay tuned for a little interview with one of the hosts of this event, Michael Weberman.
And Denise and I will be there. Are you looking forward to it, Denise?
I'm absolutely looking forward to that. That is one of the premier events each year that I look forward to, and it's very thorough.
I'm a little bit jealous.
If I were to to describe it in one word, thorough would be it. So, and we'll be talking to Michael more about that soon.
If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to have announced on the show, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com or post it on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver.
Thank you for that. So for our first interview today, we have Michael Weberman on the show. Michael is the executive director of the Farm Animal Rights Movement, a U.S.-based nonprofit organization that works to end the use of animals for food through public education and grassroots activism. Farm is the organizer of the Animal Rights National Conference, which is the world's largest and longest-running event dedicated to the liberation of animals from all forms of human exploitation and use. Michael is here today to tell us about the conference and a few other campaigns of Farm as well. Hello, Michael, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
Well, my co-host Denise and I here will be excited to attend the Animal Rights Conference next month, which is taking place in Los Angeles this year. Each year, I always talk about it on the show and describe from my perspective what it consists of, what it's like. I'm wondering if you can tell our listeners from your perspective as the organizer of the event, what is the AR conference and what are some bullet points you would like to tell to a first-time attendee to let them know what to expect?
Thanks, yeah. I wish I got to hear what you said about the conference on your show from your perspective. that'd be nice to hear what you all said. But from my perspective, actually, one thing I love is that my perspective kind of changes in different years. So my first two conferences, I was working for Farm. but I was not in a leadership role yet. And so my work at the conference was way more kind of on an hourly basis. And I mostly got to experience the conference, I think, from the perspective of an attendee. And then as I slipped into an organizer role, of course, my perspective, definitely changed in a lot of ways. And I think the one thing that's been really consistent is that I think the networking experiences and the opportunity to be around over 1,000 people who think like you, when for the rest of the year we're all kind of living in our bubbles where we are probably some of the lone people who really believe in this cause, I think that's one of the, if not the biggest benefit to the conference. I mean, obviously the presentations are wonderful and a lot of the conference is wonderful, but I think that from the first time I went as an attendee, to every time I've gone as a leader and organizer, I just find that I get so much out of the evening networking receptions and the dinners and all the time that rather than just hear content, you know, given to me from someone at a podium, that we get to share content with each other. And I think that that's something that the first time attendee we're going to be really, really blown away by, is that it's probably for many of them the first time they've been around even a couple dozen vegans, let alone hundreds or thousands of vegans. And it's just really refreshing to realize that, you know, we're not alone in this fight and that there are other people who are thinking so meaningfully and kind of taking such a thoughtful approach to these issues that, you know, that many of the first-time attendees will be having just kind of, you know, become aware of. And so I think that's really the best thing that a first-time attendee is going to get. And I actually run the newcomer orientation at the conference. So I would say that first-time attendees who are nervous about kind of being in such an overstimulating environment can feel free to attend on the first day my newcomer orientation. But overall, what I think they should be prepared for is just to be overwhelmed by great people.
Absolutely great people. So Denise has a question for you here.
Hi, Michael. You will be featuring more than 100 speakers from dozens of organizations across the world representing different experiences and paths to animal liberation. Can you tell us about some of the speakers who will be there and what they will be presenting on?
I can try. I don't want to play favorites, and we have, you know, as you said, over 100 speakers, and some of them speaking multiple times. I mean, there's no way to do justice to the breadth of speakers at the conference over a quick interview. But I will say that, you know, some of my favorites every year, that Melanie Joy comes is always a really real pleasure for me. You know, she's the author of Why We Love Dogs, Eat Pigs, and Wear Cows. And I think that she just has, you know, really one of the most brilliant approaches to understanding animal abuse and animal rights. I love that on the West Coast years, which this is in Los Angeles, that we always have Colleen Patrick Goodrow on the West Coast. So that's one of the treats for me that we don't usually get her on the East Coast. So it's always great when we're back in Los Angeles and I get to hear from Colleen Patrick Goodrow. And I personally always really appreciate the international track as well. So on one day, there is a number of international sessions, one on activism in Europe, one on activism in Asia, one on activism in Israel. And I find that for me, I learn more in a short period of time from the international ones than I do from the U.S. speakers, only because, you know, a lot of the U.S. speakers, we talk with each other so much that some of our presentations sometimes are saying somewhat similar things and have some overlap. But the international presenters really just bring, I think, more unique and fresh perspective. And so I always, you know, I don't get to attend a lot of sessions myself, obviously, because I'm helping run the event, but I always try to catch a couple of the international ones because I know that I'm going to learn something.
Well, one thing that I really appreciate about the conference myself is that you strive to represent all facets of the animal rights movement. You don't discriminate between organizations or welfareists versus abolitionists, for example. So you recognize all of these platforms and welcome them to be a part of the event. Why does FARM hold this position to be a host for the whole spectrum of the movement and not to support divisiveness?
I mean, I think it's because it's the only real way to build a movement. It's not, you know, it would not be a movement conference if we were heavily featuring our own tactics and our own perspective. That would be a farm conference. which is okay. Obviously, organizations are welcome to have their own conferences or maybe in coalitions with very, very like-minded organizations. But, you know, the animal rights movement is somewhat small, and it's obviously it's growing very, very rapidly, but it's still a small movement. And if we were to say that, you know, you're not vegan enough for this conference, or your perspective is not radical enough for this conference, or on the flip side, if we were to say that you're too mainstream for this conference, even though the fact that our movement is trying to kind of penetrate the mainstream, I think that would just be a real disservice to the attendees. And also, we've seen these fluctuations over years. You know, a number of years ago, maybe 10 years ago, we were mostly criticized for being too radical and giving too much time to the direct action speakers and not enough to the more mainstream speakers. And now, more recently, we're more likely to be criticized for the exact opposite. We're more likely to be criticized for having, you know, the more kind of suit and tie speakers there. And so for us, you know, we just know that if we were to bend to the whims of the day, if we were to have said 10 years ago, yes, we're going to ban direct action speakers, or if we were, not direct action everywhere, not their organization, but I mean the tactic of direct action, or if we were to, a few years ago, have caved in the other direction and said, yes, we're going to ban speakers who advocate for welfare reform, I just think we wouldn't grow as a movement, and we would be, you know, stuck preaching to the choir rather than learning from each other and growing.
Well, I've been attending the conference since 2007, and I'm so impressed that it just gets better and better every year in terms of content and organization. I can really tell that you do take the feedback that you get every year and put it into action to improve year after year. And that's why I appreciate the work that you do so much. So what changes will we see this year that you think will make the event better than ever?
I really appreciate you saying that, actually. I mean, you know, we spend so much time every year planning the event, and it's easy sometimes to feel that our efforts are maybe not being fully recognized or appreciated, because obviously a couple critics can be the loudest sometimes, and so it's great to hear that you do notice that we strive very, very hard to make improvements every year. And I think this year, I think we're really achieving a lot of balance this year. You know, in many years ago, we sometimes were told that we didn't give enough time to speakers, that we put too many speakers on too few panels, and that we needed to, you know, expand the programming. And last year, we went from having 4 tracks at once to 6 tracks at once. And I think maybe we went a little too far. You know, we in our effort to offer more time to speakers and offer more programming, I think sometimes there was too much going on at once, and it was too hard to choose. And so this year, we've split the difference at 5 tracks at one time, and we really tried to make sure that there's not a lot of the same, of similar content happening at the same time. So it should be pretty easy to pick. You know, it should be 5 sessions that are very, very different at any time, and it should be kind of obvious to one type of activist or another what the best session at any time is for them. And so we really tried to balance this year the need for a lot of programming with also the need to not put so many choices against each other at once that you have to miss out on a lot of good programming.
Well, that's actually why I come back every year, so I can see all the sessions that I missed in the years before. So that's a tactic, too. But I think it's really important that events like this do reach out to welcome all those who wish to attend, and hopefully that a lack of money won't be a factor in attending. And I like that Farm seems to really offer all kinds of options to make the conference as affordable as possible. So I wonder if you can highlight some of the ways that people can save money if they wish to attend.
Sure, of course. Yeah, that's definitely something we take very seriously. And I mean, and some of the opportunities are already passed at this point. You know, we have an early bird registration, which is long past, and we work really, really hard with the hotel to get the room prices down every year. And I believe we've actually sold out of our discounted room block this year. So at this point, people who are looking for a discounted room, we have a room block at a hotel down the street, which is more discounted than the hotel we're at. But the things that we do offer and that are still available now are we have group rooms. So people can just pay us $20 a night, and we will pair them up with a few other people. So not pair, but we'll team them up with a number of other people and just split a room with a few people at a very discounted rate. And we also, in addition to trying to negotiate with the hotel to keep the meal prices down, we offer free snacks In the evening, we have people offering snacks in the exhibit hall, and we offer some light breakfast. And we also offer a way to work off the price of the conference. And I know that's how I've gotten a lot of my personal friends, actually, interested in the conference. Friends of mine who are vegetarian or vegan, but maybe not so interested in the animal rights movement that they were willing to, you know, put $150 or $200 into attending an event. I told them, hey, you can work 12 hours and book free. And a number of my friends have taken up on those opportunities, and some of them have become really involved in the movement. Some of them work for other organizations now, the Humane League and Mercy for Animals. And so I know from very personal experience that this work opportunity is a really good way for someone who wants to attend but isn't sure if it's worth the money for them. You know, if they don't want to put the money down, they can. There is a way they can attend very, very free. They can work off the registration. They can attend one of those. They can join one of those group rooms. And then I think they'll find that it's definitely going to be a worthwhile experience.
Great answer. Beck has a question for you here.
Hey, Michael, this is Beck. Thanks for being on the show. I'm actually curious about some of the campaigns that you run outside of organizing this huge conference every year. Could you elaborate on some of the regular things that you do during the year?
Yeah. I mean, the conference is just one, I don't want to say one small part of what we do, because obviously it's very big, but it is only one part of what we do. The main work that we're doing all year round is educating young people about the realities of animal farming and trying to work with them to, you know, move further down the vegan path. And so we do that mostly through video education campaigns, although we have a number of other initiatives as well. But mostly we show young people videos of factory farming, either through online programs or by going to colleges and to festivals, rock concerts, and, you know, pride events. And we work with them to get a pledge from them to move towards a vegan diet. And then we try to create follow-up resources and make the vegan diet more basically doable for them. And we offer pledge levels, you know, from just going, moving towards a vegan diet a couple days a week to going full-time. And so we try to meet people where they're at and just help them do a little more for animals, you know, in their daily actions. And that's what we really focus most of the year on. But we also recognize that we don't have all the answers. And in fact, actually, this program, the paying people a dollar to watch the 4-minute video, was something that we learned about from another activist at the Animal Rights 2000, I believe it was 11 conference. And so, you know, for us, we realized that while we do, you know, most of the year our own thing, it's great that once a year we can also bring everyone together and try to see what else we can do.
Well, Michael, we've got about a minute left here, and I just wanted to note that in the past several years, we have seen a gradual growth in the number of attendees at the conference, which has been amazing. And last year, it just seemed to explode. We had a record of over 1,600 animal advocates attending. What can you attribute to this major growth in numbers? Do you think it's indicative of a quickly growing animal rights movement?
I think it is. I mean, I think a few things happened. I will give us some credit for rebranding. You know, a few years ago, we got a new logo for the conference, and we started doing a really aggressive social media push. We brought on a few new sponsors and a few old sponsors. You know, we got some groups back that hadn't been in a few years, and we got some new sponsors. And so some of the conference growth, I do think, was due to our making a very concerted effort to modernize the conference and to make that big tent even bigger. And I think some of it also is just the reality. It's just reflecting the reality that the Veg Fest are growing bigger every year. Other similar conferences are growing bigger every year. And so I think that, I think our movement really hit a new place a few years ago. And I'm glad that and proud that we were able to play a role in that and also able to capitalize on that we saw it coming. And instead of being surprised by it, you know, we got with the times. And, yeah, I mean, the conference last year, it just blew my mind. I mean, we were, when we jumped to 1,400 2 years ago, we said, okay, let's temper our expectations. Let's assume that 15 is going to be smaller rather than bigger. And instead, it was just even bigger. And so we're hoping to do that one more time again this year.
Well, I certainly can't wait for that. I'm really looking forward to it. Thank you so much for coming on the show today, Michael, to tell us about the upcoming National Animal Rights Conference, which takes place from July 7th to 10th this year in Los Angeles. For more information about the conference and to register, please visit arconference.org. And we look forward to seeing you there next month. Take care, Michael.
All Yeah, just a few weeks. I'll see you then. Thanks so much for having me.
You are listening to Animal Voices on Vancouver's Co-op Radio, 100.5 FM CFRO. 100% listener-sponsored radio, broadcasting live from the east side on unceded Coast Salish territories.
And now we have some news. In a historic move, United Egg Producers, UEP, the representative body for egg industry companies, has agreed to eliminate chick culling by 2020. After negotiations with animal rights organization, the Humane League, UAP agreed to rely on in ovo egg sexing technology, which determines the sex of chicks before birth, instead of continuing the standard practice of grinding newborn male chicks alive, since they do not serve a purpose in the egg-laying industry. UEP President and CEO Chad Gregory revealed that the union will implement the new practice as soon as it is commercially available and economically feasible industry-wide. And I just wanted to note that my first concern when I heard about this is when are chicken embryos sentient, right? Because the whole idea of this is to kill them when they're not sentient.
Yeah, I read a comment online that sort of, does that mean, so what's going to happen is instead of having the baby chicks born and they normally separate the females and the males, mm-hmm. the males are useless to the egg industry because they don't lay eggs, so they get ground up alive or suffocated to death. And instead of doing that, they're going to destroy the egg before it hatches.
Yeah, so this is infrared technology they're working on. There's a 2% difference in the DNA of males versus females in ovo. And at 3 days of incubation, they can already detect whether it's male or female. At this point, the animal doesn't have a brain, so there will be no sentience likely. The question is whether or not this is the early stage at which this will be performed. Yeah, whether when they're going to be actually doing the culling.
I think we're going to do an interview about this, Denise, because I want to know more for sure, mm-hmm. and then we'll have some answers.
Yeah.
Another news story that's local. So BC has voted, essentially, to continue the trophy hunting of grizzly bears. A review of the BC trophy hunt for these bears has yielded little change, and essentially what was supposed to be a historic overturning of the hunt ended up being simply an amendment of certain things around the hunt. So, for example, some things have been changed. The hunters who hunt for bear meat are required to keep records of it and essentially self-report their hunt, which is sort of a dubious kind of...
I don't think self-reporting ever works.
And
it's
also
quite common in the animal exploitation industries.
And a lot of trophy hunts are hidden behind, hunting for meat, when really a lot of the meat is simply tossed out the side of the truck. So follow Wildlife Defense League for updates on that, because they are currently monitoring the hunt. And as Ian McAllister said, who is the director of Pacific Wild, he says, all of these regulations simply encourage the institutionalization of the trophy hunt. So a little bit sad news there. And apparently this decision will only be able to be overturned next year. A more heartwarming news story in Cambodia, the Animal Hope and Wellness Foundation recently closed down a dog slaughterhouse, which is relevant because each year in Southeast Asia, they do have a dog meat festival. And the foundation offered the slaughterhouse owner to open a vegetarian noodle restaurant. So not only destroying his business, but actually helping him lead
that
a more...
That was Mark Ching, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly.
We had him on the show.
That's so cool.
He posted that on Facebook this week, and I was like, that's awesome. If you want to check out that interview, it's amazing. He's from the States, but he goes to these countries in Asia to fight the slaughter chick trade, and that's animalvoices.org. Look up Mark Ching. That's an amazing story, and it's great to know. I'm just happy to know that he's still safe and alive, because he's doing very dangerous activities there to save these dogs from slaughter. Thank you so much for the news.
For our feature interview today, we have ethologist Dr. Jonathan Balcombe on the show. He is the director of animal sentience at the Humane Society Institute for Science and Policy, and the author of four books, including Second Nature and Pleasurable Kingdom. He has most recently written a book called What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. The book draws upon the latest science and also shares many stories about fishes in their mysterious ocean world to help us understand them. The discoveries he shares are plentiful, and today Jonathan will speak to us about some of these insights. Hello, Jonathan, and welcome back to the Animal Voices show.
Hi, Allison.
Well, I've really been enjoying reading your book. Thank you for writing a book about the fascinating lives of fishes, because they really are fascinating, I've come to learn. However, in our society, fishes are largely misunderstood and they are underrepresented. The public really doesn't know much about them and thus seems to not care about them very much. So, as you ask in your book, why bother? Why do you think it's important to know and to care about fishes?
To be blunt in two words, because they feel. Fishes are sentient, and I spend quite a few pages presenting the science of fish sentience in the book, how they feel pain. I also talk about ways that they also experience pleasure. And so they have emotions. So they have a full spectrum. They belong firmly in the vertebrate group with all the other vertebrates. But I think it's partly that they're removed from us more than the other vertebrates, because they literally and figuratively are below the surface. They live in another realm. And it's only in the last century that technology for scuba diving, for instance, and underwater photography and filming has advanced to the point that we can really start to observe their lives in an intimate way that we couldn't before.
Can you talk about how many are killed globally and how they die? You know, this is a fact that we don't talk about it. People need to know.
Estimates vary, but a low end estimate is about 150 billion a year, and an upper end is over 2 trillion. If you line them up end to end, they'd reach the sun, possibly the sun and back. So the numbers are astronomical, and sadly, the way they die is pretty miserable. If it's commercial fishing, the most common forms of death are suffocation in air, crushing in large nets where the nets are hauled up, and the weight of all the other thousands, sometimes over a million fish in one net, just crushes most of them. And then decompression from the pressure change when they're raised up. Fishes have swim bladders in their bodies, which are gas-filled organs that allow them to control their buoyancy. And as the pressure goes down, as they're hauled up from the depths, if it's a deeper sea swimming fish, the bladder expands and crushes its neighboring organs or pushes things out of the mouth. So pretty nasty way to go. There's really been very little concern or little effort to make killing fish less inhumane. I wouldn't say there's anything humane about it to begin with.
Right. You ask in the book, why have we tended to relegate fishes beyond the outer orbit of our circle of moral concern? And I wonder this as well. I feel that this is largely because we humans find them difficult to relate to, because so much about them is so different than us. Why do you think that humans don't give fishes the consideration that they deserve?
Yeah, I think you're onto it there. I mean, they evolved in a different realm, and I think that's probably why they, in this modern era, we see them as so different. It's hard to identify them as we can. Animals who have evolved on land, breathing air, they have vocal, other animals have vocal apparatuses that we can hear them. Fishes do make a lot of sound, as I describe in the book, but it's evolved and designed for being made underwater. And they try and make sounds on land, and we often just don't even hear it. There are some exceptions to that. Also, evolving in an aquatic habitat, their eyes are permanently bathed with water. They don't need to blink, so we don't see eyelids and blinking, which makes animals seem a little bit more sentient than like us. So that's another way. These are not rigorous reasons why we should exclude them from our circle of moral concern, but I do think they have played a role in the alienation that we've had from them. And that's why I wrote the book, partly, is to show that actually if you really look into their lives, their social lives, their sex lives, their perceptions, how they think and how they feel, in particular, they are actually like us. They're very much, that's why I use the provocative term cousins, underwater cousins, in the subtitle of the book. They are really, truly, biologically and behaviorally our cousins.
Well, you've certainly done a lot of research to explore the inner lives of fishes. You have so much information to share about their abilities and how they live and communicate and feel. One of the fascinating facts I learned, for example, is how fishes react to sound and especially to music. I wonder if you could tell us about how fishes hear and about the studies that have been done with them in music.
Yeah, I talk about two major types of studies in the book, two major studies, one done in the U.S., one done in a lab in Greece. The first one showing that fishes, in this case, it was koi, which are in the carp family, they discriminate music, that they can be taught to push a button to, in response to, say, a classical music versus the blues or something. And then you can test them later with new kinds of classical music or new kinds of blues music, and you can find that they're able to generalize from those original stimuli that they heard, and they can recognize them. And they can recognize, I guess, through sound patterns, through rhythms, the kinds of instruments used, just as we do. I mean, I say just as we do. We don't know what kind of experience they're having, but they clearly have the ability to make those fine discriminations. So that's one characteristic they've been shown to have. Another is that they also appear to have preferences for music, and this is the study done in Greece that I talk about. They were presented with different kinds of music, and then they were also presented with just white noise or human voices, and they didn't show any particular response in terms of growth rate or calming response when they heard just ordinary white noise or human voices. But if they were played human music, certain types of music appeared to be appealing to them. There's other possible explanations for that, but there was definitely a differential response that they found in the study, suggesting that they may enjoy some kinds of music more than others.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we humans have music preferences as well, and there's been studies done to show that humans actually thrive under classical music, for example, and we're starting to learn here as I'm reading your book that perhaps we are really not that much different from fishes in some ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, some skeptics could scoff and say, oh, a fish appreciating music, give me a break. But the fact is, I do present examples at various parts of the book where fishes show preferences, which is a very natural thing to do in an organism that has a brain, has emotions, and can choose things. They're autonomous beings under there. They choose mates. They choose nesting sites. They choose shoal partners and that sort of thing. And they can feel pleasure. And if you can feel pleasure, that may include aesthetics. Look at the beauty of fishes and coral reefs. I mean, there's some various reasons why they may have evolved bright colors and patterns on their bodies. We certainly appreciate them for their beauty, hence the popularity of the troublesome aquarium trade. But we shouldn't exclude the idea that they also appreciate beauty, and that's shown in courtship behavior and other aspects of their social lives.
Yeah, well, another amazing ability of fishes that I want to talk about is navigation. You say that the navigation feats of salmon are the stuff of legend. And I finally discovered myself how salmon return to their natal streams to spawn by reading your book. So the secret has been revealed. I'm wondering if you can tell us how this works, please.
Isn't it silly that there's still this persistent belief that fishes have a very short memory, like the perceived notion of the 3-second memory of the goldfish? It's been debunked repeatedly, and I do talk about that in the book. But certainly, I mean, most people have heard that salmon return to their natal streams where they were born years later after living in the open ocean. And well, if that isn't a kind of memory, I don't know what is. They may be following chemical gradients. There's various ways that they may be doing that. Certainly, a lot of fishes have very good geomagnetic orientation, where they can sense the Earth's magnetic fields as birds do. But there was an interesting study where they actually dripped different chemicals in fairly small amounts in the home streams of different young salmon when they were young, when they swim out to sea. And then they dripped them in a few years later. They tagged these fishes, and they found that the fishes are almost like something like 95% or 98%. They swam back up to their correct original streams, clearly orienting into the chemical differences between those streams. And, you know, different streams have different vegetation around them. There's reasons why you're going to get a different flavor, if you like, maybe figuratively or maybe literally a flavor. And they're very, very have very good chemical sense. But there's many other ways fishes use their memories as well, and I describe those in the book.
So let's talk about fish and pain. An argument you will often hear to justify violence against fishes is that it doesn't matter if we're cruel to them because they can't feel pain. So you say it goes against your deepest intuition to think otherwise, and I agree with you. However, some people want more of a scientific explanation. So can you tell us about some reasons to expect that fishes are sentient?
Rather than go through all of the evidence I present in the book, let me just describe one study, which I think is pretty convincing just by itself. It involved zebra fishes, which are small, really attractive, stripy fishes, very commonly used in laboratory research now. And in this study, which wasn't especially fish-friendly, but was nevertheless revealing, and I do believe in presenting this information if it helps the fishes, they had a group of zebra fishes in a complex tank that had two main chambers. One was a rich chamber that was enriched with plants and rocks and places they could hide and fishes like that, you know, just a stimulating environment. And the other chamber was barren. It was empty. And they all avoided that empty chamber. They all hung out in the enriched chamber. And then they divided the zebra fishes into two groups, and they all got injected. And one group got injected with an acid, which is known to cause pain and lasting pain in many animals. And then the other group got injected with saline solution, which would have meant they'd have felt the prick of the initial injection, but not much for long after that, because saline is pretty benign. And then they watched the fishes, and they all remained in the enriched tank until they dissolved a painkiller, lidocaine, in the barren chamber, the unpreferred chamber, the ones that they all avoided. And lo and behold, some of the zebra fishes started swimming over there soon after that time, and they would hang out in this normally objectionable tank. And it was only the ones who'd received the acid injection. So I consider that a pretty, for want of a better term, elegant, if not necessarily humane, way of demonstrating that these guys feel pain. They feel it lasts, and they will take action to relieve it if they can.
Well, I want to talk about fish and consciousness. There's been an argument that fish aren't conscious. You talk about this in your book, and you coined the term corticocentrism. What is that?
Well, mammals actually are the only group of vertebrates that have what we call a neocortex. It's that cauliflower convoluted part of the brain. We're all familiar with that because we celebrate our own human brain so much. We get a little obsessive about that. And I mentioned that it's only mammals that have it because that's really significant, because the argument that's commonly raised to try to argue that by certain scientists, and I'm going to say a dwindling number, that's commonly raised to suggest that fishes cannot feel pain is that they don't have this part of the brain. Well, the fact is neither do birds, neither do any of the other vertebrates, and nobody's really seriously debating that birds cannot feel pain. The evidence is so clear. And so that argument by itself is really, really cynical and weak, in my view, all the more so up against the evidence that shows that fishes have the anatomy, they have the physiology, they have the behavioral responses and the memory and the distraction, et cetera, from presumably painful stimuli that shows that they react much as we do.
Well, getting more into the inner lives of fishes, they really are all complex individuals. They have likes and dislikes, extreme sensitivities, and intelligence demonstrated in areas such as facial recognition and tool use. And like us, they are social creatures as well. I love hearing stories about the social contracts between animals, and you have a whole chapter dedicated to this, which was fascinating to me. I wonder if you can speak to us about the whole culture of cleaner fishes and their clients.
Thanks for using the word culture. I appreciate that. And so do the fishes, because they do have culture. They do have characteristics that are not genetically transferred, but are nevertheless behaviorally transferred through generations, which is the biological definition of culture. And certainly the cleaner client mutualism or symbiosis is one of the most spectacular examples of a plus-plus relationship among different species of animals. That's what a symbiosis is. And it involves cleaner fishes of various species, but the blue-striped cleaner wrasse would be one of the best known and best studied. There's over 100 articles, well over 100 articles published on these interactions. They perform a business service. They have a business relationship with so-called client fishes of over 100 different species on the reef. The client fishes line up to wait their turn to be serviced by these cleaners who swim into their open mouths and in and out of their gills, plucking off parasites, removing algae and what have you. The clients are very cooperative. They open their mouths and spread their gill covers to allow these fishes to do this. The cleaners are usually very small and sometimes hundreds of times smaller than their clients, some of whom are large, scary, predaceous fishes, but they never eat the cleaners. It just isn't a good way to do business, to eat your business partner. And it's really quite Machiavellian. There's, as you say, a social contract going on here. These are not willy-nilly interactions. The clients know the cleaners. They return to the cleaning stations of their favorite cleaners. So there's individual recognition and memory at work here. And related to that, they are observing the performance of cleaners to see what quality of service they're giving on that particular day. The fact is, cleaners sometimes do a better job than other times, and some cleaners are better at giving service than others. They'll work in pairs, sometimes trios or even more. I've seen this on reefs. And it's been found, among many findings, that when there are lots of clients watching, cleaners tend to do a better job. So it's what's called an audience effect. So they're actually tuned in and aware of how many and who's watching, and they don't want to sully their reputations, so they do a good job. It's a little bit like eBay ratings, because the clients are forming image scores. That's the term the scientists use for this. They're keeping accounts over time, which is a pretty sophisticated cognitive feat. And if there's very few or no clients there, the cleaners are being shown to not generally do as good a service. They may nip a bit of mucus off the skin of the client, which clients don't like. It makes them jolt. And there's also imposters who mimic cleaners. So it is a pretty complex relationship. It's new information coming out on it quite regularly.
Well, another aspect about fishes that I think virtually no one knows about is their sex lives. But you know a lot about this, Jonathan. Can you tell us some fascinating facts about the sexual lives of fishes?
Well, there's quite a lot to talk about. Fishes certainly have the most varied sexual systems of any of the vertebrates. We can talk about promiscuity, polygyny, polyandry, sequential and long-term monogamy, harem keeping, territoriality, group spawning, sneak copulation, satellite male strategies, or simultaneous and sequential hermaphroditism, just to name a few. Or we can also talk about fake orgasms by brown trout, or if you like, we can talk about sperm drinking by Corydoras catfishes. Do you have any preference for any of those tonight, Allison?
I know I read about those in the book, but I kind of want to keep it a bit tamer. So how about, okay, this is what I found fascinating, that you said in your book, more than one quarter of all fishes on a reef can transition between genders. And you even spoke about variety of fish that only come in the female gender. Maybe you can speak about gender and gender transition.
Sure. It is a pretty cool and useful adaptation for some fishes, particularly on reefs. About a quarter of reef fishes are able to change gender with no expensive surgery involved. And you have examples such as the clownfish, famous from Finding Nemo. This is these cute little stripy ones that live among the anemones. The typical social structure of these ones is that you have a chain of males, and then you have a top-ranking female who's sort of the biggest one. And the males are all in a rank, and the largest male is the one who's the alpha male, and he mates with the female. And if the alpha male were to die or disappear, then the next male in the chain moves up to that position and replaces him. If the top female dies, then the top male becomes the top female. He changes gender quite quickly, and he assumes the role of the female. So that's just one example of many of how labile the sexual assignment, the gender assignment, is for these fishes. I think humans could learn a little bit there. I don't think the fishes have ever had to pass legislation about this, but it's encouraging that we are finally coming to terms with the fact that people are not always simply assigned to one gender when they're born.
Finally, the much-anticipated film Finding Dory comes out today in theaters, one day before Save a Fish Day on June 18th tomorrow. What are your thoughts on how this film may help but also harm the fishes in the world, especially the blue tangs as featured in the movie? And what would you like to say to our listeners about appreciating fishes and keeping them in captivity?
Good question. I mean, films like that reach masses of people, and they can have different results and different impacts. And I certainly see valuable aspects of films like that. They can help people to relate and think about fishes as having real lives. I do hope that people don't think it's all make-believe, because there is some decent science that underlies some of what's talked about. But of course, the animators also take a lot of liberties, and that may sort of undermine some of the seriousness of these films. They're beautifully done, of course, and brilliantly done. Certainly, there is the concern for fads. There was a big rush on purchasing these clownfishes after Finding Nemo came out. And the irony is that people, you know, they're fascinated. They love these guys. They want to have them in their homes. And of course, they're contributing to the not very nice practices of the aquarium collection trade. At that time, clownfishes were not easily, no one had really figured out a way to breed them in captivity. So most of them were coming from wild collections on reefs in Indonesia and wherever else they're found. And the methods used to collect fishes from reefs are often really bad, like cyanide poisoning, which kills many and damages the coral. Explosives have the same effect. So, and then the fishes have to put up with long-term transportation, sometimes across continents. Many die in transit. And many die shortly after ending up in aquariums, where the people, well-meaning people with them, have no clue about how to properly look after them. And even then, you can't really properly mimic their environments in a typical fish tank. So it's really problematic, and there's definitely a concern that this is going to happen again with blue tangs. And to its credit, Disney is putting out a press release to essentially say that, you know, please don't. You know, we want Dory found in the film, but we don't want you going out and finding Dory, because these fishes belong on their reef habitats, not in people's tanks.
Absolutely. Thank you for coming on the show today, Jonathan, to speak to us about some of the fascinating information in your new book, What a Fish Knows, The Inner Lives of Our Underwater Cousins. I encourage people to read this book to learn so much more, to be able to appreciate and understand fishes. Thanks, Jonathan. Have a great day.
Thanks, Allison.
You have been listening to Animal Voices on 100.5 FM CFRO Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Canada. Please join us on our next show next Friday, June the 24th. We'll be having Dustin Harder, the vegan roadie, here live in the studio. He's on a vegan foodie road tour right now with a stop slated for Vancouver next week, and he'll be on the show to tell us all about his vegan food travel adventures. We here at Animal Voices want to connect with you online. Animalvoices.org is where you can stream shows or download the shows as podcasts, read our show blog with detailed links, and subscribe via iTunes. Stay in touch with us via our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, and join us on Twitter at Animal Voices YVR. We are an all-volunteer-run radio station and show, and we need help. If you're interested in producing or hosting shows or doing interviews, and you have good organizational skills and are familiar with the issue of animal advocacy and veganism, please send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We can use your help, and training will be provided. You can also send us your suggestions and comments about the show, either on Facebook or via email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We're closing the show now with a remix of the song Under the Sea by the A-Teens, a Swedish teen band which no longer exists, unfortunately,
from the 1980s.
Stay tuned for Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
We're stepping in, we're not stepping out. Well, I know, sir, this is how your teens have big up this style.